So begin on the Dhammanupassana section proper, and it begins with the contemplation of the five hindrances. The next. And I'll read from Bhikkhu Vinalayo's introductory section on this, just to begin. The next contemplation in the Satipatthana Sutta is concerned with a specific set of mental qualities, the five hindrances. These come as the first among the contemplations of Dhammas. Before embarking on a closer inspection of this exercise, I will examine the implications of the term Dhammas in order to provide some background to the exercises listed under this fourth and last Satipatthana. The term Dhamma can assume a variety of meanings, depending on the context in which it occurs. Most translators take the term Dhammas in the Satipatthana Sutta to mean mental objects, in the sense of whatever can become an object of the mind, in contradistinction to the objects of the other five senses. In regard to Satipatthana, however, this rendering appears strange. If the term Dhammas were to refer to objects of the mind, then the other three Satipatthanas should also be included here, since they too can become objects of the mind. Moreover, one of the exercises listed under the fourth Satipatthana is contemplation of the six senses together with their respective objects. So this contemplation of Dhammas is not confined to the objects of the mind as the sixth sense only. In fact, the Dhammas listed in the fourth Satipatthana, such as the hindrances and the aggregates, etc., do not naturally evoke the classification mental objects. What this Satipatthana is actually concerned with are specific mental qualities, such as the five hindrances and the seven awakening factors, and analyses of experience into specific categories, such as the five aggregates, the six sense spheres, and the Four Noble Truths. These mental factors and categories constitute central aspects of the Buddha's way of teaching, the Dhamma. These classificatory schemes are not in themselves the objects of meditation, but constitute frameworks or points of reference to be applied during contemplation. During actual practice, one is to look at whatever is experienced in terms of these Dhammas. Thus, the Dhammas mentioned in this Satipatthana are not, quote-unquote, mental objects, but are applied to whatever becomes an object of the mind or any other sense door during contemplation. The expression, contemplation of Dhammas, occurs also in the Anapanasati Sutta in relation to the last four of the 16 steps for developing mindfulness of breathing, which are concerned with contemplating impermanence, fading away, cessation, and letting go. At first sight, the four steps described here appear to be quite different from the mental factors and categories listed under contemplation of Dhammas in the Satipatthana Sutta. The Buddha's reason for classifying these final four steps of mindfulness of breathing as contemplation of Dhammas was that at this more advanced point of practice, a meditator will have overcome desires and discontent, thereby becoming established in equanimity. The commentaries indicate that this is a reference to the removal of the hindrances. Although taking desires and discontent to represent the whole set of the five hindrances is questionable, this explanation provides a link between the final four steps of mindfulness of breathing and the sequence of Dhammas in the Satipatthana Sutta, since these begin with the hindrances. According to the commentaries, The hindrances lead the contemplations of Dhammas because their removal serves as a basis for developing the comparatively sophisticated contemplations in this last Satipatthana. A further parallel between the two discourses is that the 16-step scheme for mindfulness of breathing leads to the development of the awakening factors, since the awakening factors also form part of the contemplation of Dhammas in the Satipatthana Sutta. These parallels suggest that a temporal progression towards realization could form the key aspect of contemplation of Dhammas in both cases. In the Satipatthana context, this progression underlies the sequential order of the mental factors and categories detailed for contemplation of Dhammas. Based on a sufficient degree of mental stability through overcoming the hindrances, contemplation of Dhammas proceeds to an analysis of subjective personality in terms of the five aggregates and to an analysis of the relation between subjective personality and the outer world in terms of the six sense spheres. These two analyses form a convenient basis for developing the awakening factors, whose successful establishment constitutes a necessary condition for awakening. To awaken is to fully understand the Four Noble Truths as they really are, this being the final exercise among the contemplations of Dhammas and the successful culmination of Satipatthana practice. With the final four steps of mindfulness of breathing, however, the emphasis is mainly directed towards the insights gained through contemplation of Dhammas. These proceed from the direct experience of the impermanent nature of phenomena to giving attention to their fading away and cessation. These in turn lead to detachment or letting go, a state of mind fit for awakening. Contemplation of Dhammas in both the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta, then, indicates a temporal progression towards detachment and realization. Although the breakthrough to realization can take place while practicing any of the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, the final four steps appear to be specifically designed to this end. Similarly, although realization can take place while one is engaged in any of the Satipatthana contemplations, the final section of the Satipatthana Sutta, concerned with the contemplation of Dhammas, stands out for its particular emphasis on achieving this goal. In contrast to the previous Satipatthanas, contemplation of Dhammas is particularly concerned with recognizing the conditioned nature of the phenomena under observation. In fact, the main instruction for most of the contemplation of Dhammas directly mentions conditionality, while in the previous Satipatthanas, this happens only in the refrain. The prominence of conditionality in this Satipatthana brings to mind the well-known statement that one who sees dependent co-arising sees the Dhamma. Such seeing of the Dhamma may well come about through contemplating Dhammas, a suggestion which also squares well with the acquisition of the method mentioned in the direct path passage of the Satipatthana Sutta as a goal of practice. Thus, contemplation of Dhammas skillfully applies Dhammas, that is, classificatory categories, as taught in the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, during contemplation in order to bring about an understanding of the Dhamma, principle of conditionality, and lead to the realization of the highest of all Dhammas, phenomena, Nibbana. So he's warping our minds here with the use of Dhamma. The first of the contemplations of Dhammas is, in a way, a more specific version of contemplation of states of mind, since it turns awareness to five manifestations of the three unwholesome roots, the five hindrances, In contrast to the preceding contemplation of the mind, however, contemplation of the hindrances covers not only the presence or absence of a hindrance, but also the conditions underlying the presence or absence of each hindrance. In my exploration, I will follow the two-stage pattern of this instruction by focusing initially on the five hindrances and the importance of recognizing them, and considering subsequently the conditions for their presence or absence. The Satipatthana instructions for contemplating the hindrances are, if sensual desire is present in him, he knows there is sensual desire in me. If sensual desire is not present in him, he knows there is no sensual desire in me. And he knows how unarisen sensual desire can arise, how arisen sensual desire can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed sensual desire can be prevented. And of course the same for aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry. And then I'll finish it off with doubt. If doubt is present in him, he knows there is doubt in me. If doubt is not present in him, he knows there is no doubt in me. And he knows how unarisen doubt can arise, how arisen doubt can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed doubt can be prevented. The use of the term hindrance, nivarana, clearly indicates why these mental qualities have been singled out for special attention. They hinder the proper functioning of the mind. Under the influence of the hindrances, one is unable to understand one's own good or that of others, or to gain concentration or insight. Learning to withstand the impact of a hindrance with awareness is therefore an important skill for one's progress on the path. According to the discourses, difficulties in counterbalancing a hindrance are a good reason for approaching an experienced meditator to ask for practical guidance. So that's a bit of an introduction. And then I thought, I would do a reading from the Maha Asapura Sutta, which is one of the well-known mentions and probably the most vivid similes that the Buddha uses for dealing with the hindrances. But then I thought, well, actually it's not, the Maha Asapura Sutta gives a whole kind of overview of the path. So I thought, well, because it, rather than putting the dealing with the hindrances outside of a kind of a comprehensive path, better read the prologue to it, and then similarly the result of abandoning the hindrances, the arising of concentrated states of mind is described again also in the probably the most vivid way. So I thought I'd read that as well, so that one sees the hindrances in the context of both the things to work with and leading up to and supporting the removal of the hindrances, and then the fruits of the of that in terms of concentration. I won't go on to the further than that. So the Maha Asapura Sutta is Majjhima 39. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Angan country at a town of the Angans named Asapura. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Recluses, recluses, bhikkhus, that is how people perceive you. And when you are asked, what are you? You claim that you are recluses, samana. Since that is what you are designated and what you claim to be, you should train thus. We will undertake and practice those things that make one a recluse, that make one a Brahman, so that our designations may be true and our claims genuine, and so that the services of those whose robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites we use shall bring them great fruit and benefit, and so that our going forth shall not be in vain, but fruitful and fertile. And what, bhikkhus, are the things that make one a recluse, that make one a Brahman? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. We will be possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. So Hiriyotapa. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. That much is enough. That much has been done. The goal of recluseship has been reached, and there is nothing more for us to do. And you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse's status do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our bodily conduct shall be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained, and we will not laud ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified bodily conduct. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing, and our bodily conduct has been purified. That much is enough. That much has been done. The goal of recluseship has been reached. There is nothing more for us to do. And you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse's status do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to do, while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Because you should train thus. Our verbal conduct shall be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained, and we will not laud ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified verbal conduct. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct has been purified, and our verbal conduct has been purified. That much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse's status do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our mental conduct shall be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained. And we will not laud ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified mental conduct. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct and verbal conduct have been purified, and our mental conduct has been purified. That much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse's status do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our livelihood shall be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained, and we will not laud ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified livelihood. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, and mental conduct have been purified, and our livelihood has been purified. That much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse's status do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. We will guard the doors of our sense faculties. On seeing a form with the eye, we will not grasp at its signs and features, since if we left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade us. We will practice the way of its restraint. We will guard the eye faculty. We will undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind. We will not grasp at its signs and features, since, if we left the mind faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade us. We will practice the way of its restraint. We will guard the mind faculty. We will undertake the restraint of the mind faculty. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct, and livelihood have been purified, and we guard the doors of our sense faculties. That much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse status, do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. We will be moderate in eating, reflecting wisely. We will take food neither for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort, and for assisting the holy life, considering. Thus I shall terminate old feelings without arising new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless, and shall live in comfort. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct, and livelihood have been purified. We guard the doors of our sense faculties, and we are moderate in eating. That much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse status, do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. We will be devoted to wakefulness. During the day, while walking back and forth and sitting, we will purify our minds of obstructive states. In the first watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, we will purify our minds of obstructive states. In the middle watch of the night, we will lie down on the right side in the lion's pose, with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in our minds the time for rising. After rising, in the third watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, we will purify our mind of obstructive states. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct, and livelihood have been purified. We guard the doors of our senses. We guard the doors of our sense faculties. We are moderate in eating, and we are devoted to wakefulness. That much is enough, and you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse status, do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. We will be possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. We will act in full awareness when going forward and returning. We will act in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. We will act in full awareness when flexing and extending our limbs. We will act in full awareness when wearing our robes and carrying our outer robe and bowl. We will act in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting. We will act in full awareness when defecating and urinating. We will act in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Now, bhikkhus, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct, and livelihood have been purified. We guard the doors of our sense faculties. We are moderate in eating. We are devoted to wakefulness, and we are possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. That much is enough. That much has been done. The goal of recluseship has been reached. There is nothing more for us to do, and you may rest content with that much. Bhikkhus, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse status do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu resorts to a secluding resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. On returning from his alms round after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with the mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. Because suppose a man were to take a loan and undertake business, and his business were to succeed so that he could repay all the money of the old loan, and there would remain enough extra to maintain a wife. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill, and his food would not agree with him, and his body had no strength. But later he would recover from the affliction, and his food would agree with him, and his body would regain strength. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were imprisoned in a prison house, but later he would be released from prison, safe and secure, with no loss to his property. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were a slave, not self-dependent, but dependent on others, unable to go where he wants, but later on he would be released from slavery, self-dependent, independent of others, a freed man able to go where he wants. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man with wealth and property were to enter a road across a desert, but later on he would cross over the desert, safe and secure, with no loss to his property. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. So too, bhikkhus, when these five hindrances are unabandoned in himself, a bhikkhu sees them respectively as a debt, a disease, a prison house, slavery, and a road across a desert. But when these five hindrances have been abandoned in himself, he sees that as freedom from debt, healthiness, release from prison, freedom from slavery, and a land of safety. Having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. He makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Just as a skilled bathman or bathman's apprentice heaps bath powder in a metal basin and, sprinkling it gradually with water, kneads it until the moisture wets his ball of bath powder, soaks it, and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball itself does not ooze. So too, a bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Again, bhikkhus, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. He makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Just as though there were a lake whose waters welled up from below, and it had no inflow from the east, west, north, or south, and would not be replenished from time to time by showers of rain. Then the cool fount of water welling up in the lake would make the cool water drench, steep, fill, and pervade the lake, so that there would be no part of the whole lake unpervaded by cool water. So too, a bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Again, bhikkhus, with the fading away as well of rapture, a bhikkhu abides in equanimity, and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. He makes the pleasure divested of rapture, drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it, and cool water drenches, steeps, fills, and pervades them to their tips and their roots, so that there is no part of all those lotuses unpervaded by cool water. So too, a bhikkhu makes the pleasure divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. Again, bhikkhus, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. He sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Just as though a man were sitting covered from the head down with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his whole body unpervaded by the white cloth. So too, a bhikkhu sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. And of course, this goes on to the development of the three true knowledges, the recollection of past lives, the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings, and then that knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. And then the Buddha ends it with a sort of an emphasis on this being the goal of a recluse. So that's what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied, delighted in the Blessed One's words. So I think as I said at the beginning, recognizing that the hindrances are a particular focus of attention to develop, but they're also within a spectrum of a practice that we are cultivating and developing, and to also be attending to to those other elements, because those will support the abandoning of the hindrances, restraint of the senses, wakefulness, moderation in eating, mindfulness, hiriyotapa, the attention to the purification of actions of body, speech, and mind. It is all conjoined. There is nothing disjoined. The nature of the Buddha's teachings, there's this intricate web of factors and a phenomena that we work with. And then there's, of course, the Buddha using these images, and I think one of the purposes of these images is emphasizing the fact that when we do relinquish these hindrances, it's for our well-being and happiness. He would be glad and full of joy, and that's and this is an important factor of our cultivation, being able to experience a certain lightness of being, which is also which really, to me, it really begins right at the very beginning of these statements of we will not laud ourselves and disparage others. You know, that sense of let's say a very firm foundation for growth and development in the Buddhist teachings of not having to feel that one needs to lift oneself up or put others down in some way or compare oneself to others. Recognizing the intrinsic value of both the relinquishing and abandoning of what is unwholesome and the cultivation of what is good and wholesome, and that is a great source of well-being. And then also the emphasis in that development of concentration and stillness, how much those images that the Buddha gives are concerned with the body, so that mindfulness and awareness and a clarity and sort of a firm establishing of one's attention and awareness is rooted in the body, and that sense of anchor of knowing is not, again, it's not disjoint, it's not disembodied. There's a very solid anchor of one's experience of being. Any questions on that? Well, if you're using it to distract it or getting caught in the distraction, then yes, it's going to be diffuse. But if you're using it to settle and kind of pervade, because it's inevitable that there's a, just the nature of attention is again, it's not disjoint. There's always going to be a primary object and a secondary recognition of so that sometimes we feel that that anything that is impinging on our noting of a particular object is extraneous, but it's not extraneous, it's natural, so that we end up in this kind of argument with ourselves, trying to dismiss an act of mind which is quite ordinary. So that it's just is that, and then the so that when one is using whatever your primary object is, and then it's being supported by the well-being and integration of the other aspects of subsidiary aspects of awareness, then it works together. So that there's I think it's important to reflect on our assumptions of what we think we need to do in order to be concentrated. Because sometimes we actually block the ability of the mind to really settle by trying to clarify the object too much. And neglect to recognize, oh well, it's actually natural. And when it's integrated with integrated with the feeling of well-being and kind of, you know, relaxation, tranquility within the body and the mind, then there's the transitions to the mind settling and stabilizing are much more fluid and facilitated.
Was that kind of integration of all those experiences part of what leads to also the unification?
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah, that's how how Ajahn Chah in the reading that I gave, and how he talked about it, of how, you know, one can, it's easy for one to get a doubt, because that a kakata. I mean, fortunately, in the English language, I mean, it's that it's being translated as unification of mind, which the previous translations were one-pointed, and again feeds that assumption of, well, one-pointed should be one thing; it shouldn't have other things in it. But the unification is integration, balance. Everything working together, so that there's not that disharmony, so that the different factors of awareness, that application of mind, how's that Jin Jeff translated? No, of vitakka and vichara. Evaluation, yeah. Directed thought and evaluation. So those are not a disruption to unification of mind. Those are a part of the unification of mind, or how they have, well, it has piti and sukha as well. So you think, well, it should only have one thing. Well, it's not that way. It works together and harmonizes. So there's a web of mental factors that work together to provide a base of support for clarity and well-being.
There was one interesting distinction I read from Ajahn Jeff, along those lines, with ekagata versus
Ekodipaya.
And I know Bhikkhu Bodhi's kind of gone back and forth with translating those two terms differently, one time using the singleness of mind, the other time using unification. But I think maybe I saw somewhere that Ajahn Chah translated the first ekagata, like in the first time, as I think Tikhava was mentioned, the singleness of preoccupation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one, unification.
It's a slightly different slant. And sometimes it's good to make those distinctions, and sometimes you might end up pay attention to the resolving those five hindrances and experiencing a sense of well-being and tranquility, and let the mind settle. Sometimes those nuances it can be drawn out, but I think it's in terms of practice to let the mind settle.